Module 3 is Approaches to Financial Planning. This covers Chapter 3 in the textbook, so let's go ahead and get out our study sheet. And as you can see, we're going to be talking about various different approaches to financial planning. You may have thought that there were just one or two approaches to financial planning, but there's quite a few, and we'll go through most of them, including the life cycle approach and the different panel approaches. We'll also talk about saving and budgeting. We'll start off, though, by going through the different approaches to financial planning. We'll start by talking about the life cycle approach. We'll go through the different panel approaches, the two-panel approach and the three-panel approach. We'll go through the strategic and cash flow approaches to financial planning. We'll talk about other approaches to financial planning, and we'll wrap up this module by discussing budgeting and saving. Let's start off, though, by talking about the life cycle approach to financial planning. When we talked about in Module 1 the phases of the financial planning process, we talked about analyzing, evaluating, and developing recommendations. And one way that we can approach that is through the life cycle approach. Each of the approaches we're going to talk about with respect to financial planning is useful and provides the planner and client with a slightly different perspective. So let's focus on a few of these. The life cycle approach is an approach to financial planning. It's a broad view of the client financial profile. It matches a client's goals with their current stage in the life cycle. I actually think that the life cycle approach is a great approach to financial planning. It looks at a client's age and attempts to place them in one or more stages of a common life cycle. A majority of a client's goals and lifestyle can be explained by their stage in the life cycle. There are three distinct stages or phases under the life cycle approach. The first phase is the asset accumulation phase, and this is where the client is building their assets. They're starting to save, they're building their career potentially. Usually starts right when they get out of college and start working. There's the conservation, also known as the risk management phase, which is phase 2. And the distribution or gifting phase, which is phase 3. And you may be thinking, well, stage 1 begins at age 21, lasts to age 35. Then stage 2 begins at age 35, lasts to age 55. And then stage 3 begins at age 55 and lasts until death. And that's not exactly the case. The first thing to note is that each client is different. And the second thing to note is that these stages sometimes overlap, and a client can be in multiple stages at once. In fact, it's actually possible for someone in their mid-40s to be in all three of these different stages at the same time. A client's risks and goals may not always align with those in the stage that they would expect to be in given their age, so you have to look at each person individually. Let's go through each one of these stages. And the first one is the asset accumulation phase, and that begins in the early 20s, usually when the client enters the workforce, maybe gets out of college, starts working. Early 20s is when the asset accumulation phase generally begins. It lasts typically to mid-50s, but that's not always the case. This is just an average ballpark range of ages. The primary focus during this phase is on accumulating assets. There is limited additional cash for investing during this phase, especially the younger the person is. Someone in their early 20s usually doesn't have a lot of excess cash for investing. As they get a little bit older, maybe in their 40s, they might have more excess cash. But during this phase, additional cash for investing is typically low. And the debt to net worth ratio is high. And that makes sense. Someone in their 20s, probably going to have a mortgage, maybe saving for retirement, saving for child's college education. So that's the asset accumulation phase. It is phase 1. As you can see, though, it's generally a pretty long phase. If it's early 20s to mid-50s, that could be 30 or 35 years. Phase number 2 is the wealth conservation phase, which is also known as the risk management phase. And this starts either in the late 20s or early 30s and may last all the way to the early 70s. So as you can see, someone who's in their mid-30s or 40 years old, they're going to be in the asset accumulation phase as well as this wealth conservation phase. They'll be in both phases at the same time. It usually starts when the client is considering starting a family, and it's the stage when wealth conservation and risk management are the focus. So we can see overlap. We often do see overlap of someone who's in their mid-30s being in both of these phases at the same time. Under this wealth conservation phase, there's a need to plan for events that could impact long-term planning goals and financial stability. And if you remember before, we said that this phase is also called the risk management phase, and the reason is because in this phase, we're planning for an untimely death, maybe through the use of life insurance, accidents and illnesses, such as through disability insurance, medical insurance, and even unemployment. We're planning for that during the conservation phase. And then finally, we have the distribution phase, and that's the last phase under this approach, and it's referred to as the wealth distribution slash gifting phase, and this could be in the mid-50s. And actually, this phase might begin in the mid-40s. It just depends on the person, and it lasts to the end of life. So someone who's, let's say, 50 years old may very well be in all three phases at the same time. The client during this phase is concerned with living off of accumulated assets, and they're also concerned with preserving wealth for future generations or philanthropic purposes. This phase is typically represented by high cash flow, low debt, maybe the mortgage is paid off, and a high net worth. As we said before, the clients can be in two of the phases at the same time, or maybe even all three phases at the same time. The conservation phase may also come before the accumulation phase if there's an early death. Some common life cycle goals that we try to plan for are starting a family and retirement planning, and some common risks that we try to plan for under this approach are disability, untimely death, and also potential liability. So let's do a practice question. Juanita, age 60, is married and has two daughters in college. Her primary goals are saving for retirement, supporting her daughters until they graduate from college, and structuring her estate to provide for her daughters and their future families. Which phase or phases of the life cycle approach is Juanita mostly in? And in just looking at this scenario, she is age 60, and it does not look like she's in the asset accumulation phase of the life cycle approach. But it does look like she is showing that she might be, based on her age and her goals, in the other two phases of the life cycle approach. She wants to leave a legacy to her daughters, their families. She was saving for retirement and supporting her daughters until they graduate from college. So based on that, she's managing risks. She wants to leave a legacy. She's not in the asset accumulation phase at age 60. And so the best answer here is D. She's in the conservation risk management phase and the distribution gifting phases. So she's in the last two phases of the life cycle approach. D is our answer. Let's talk about two additional approaches to financial planning, the panel approaches. We're going to talk about the two-step approach and then the three-step approach. We'll start off by talking about the two-step approach to financial planning, and that involves the following steps: managing risk, that's step number one, and saving and investing, that's step number two. Step number one is managing the risk. We want to cover the risks during this step of the two-step approach. Personal risks could potentially lead to catastrophic loss, such as an untimely death, disability, illness, and so forth. We want to manage those risks in step one. Insurance is recommended in this step to cover the risks of premature death or disability. And then step two is saving and investing. Saving for goals and investing for retirement occurs during this step. And this step could include contributing to a 401k plan or setting up a monthly savings plan. That's the two-step approach. And we can further expand that two-step approach to include a third step, and we call that the three-panel approach. So the three-panel approach just expands upon the first two steps that we just mentioned under the two-step approach. The three-panel approach is similar to the two-step approach, but the second step, which is saving and investing, is broken up into two pieces under the three-panel approach. Under the three-panel approach, the saving and investing step is divided up into short-term saving and investing and long-term saving and investing. So the panels of the three-panel approach are panel one, covering catastrophic risks, which is managing risks. Panel two is meeting short-term obligations and managing debt. And then panel three is meeting financial security goals, looking at the long-term savings and long-term goals. Let's go through each panel individually. We'll start with panel one. That involves risk management. And when we're managing risks, we're looking at personal risks, such as risk of untimely death or unemployment or disability, property risks, such as homeowner's liability, auto liability, and then other liability risks as well. Maybe we need an umbrella policy or something like that. We do want to evaluate potentially catastrophic risks in panel one. And that would include evaluating the need for life insurance, health insurance, disability, long-term care insurance as well, even property and liability insurance. For example, property insurance would include homeowners and auto insurance, and liability insurance would include something like an umbrella policy. Panel two involves short-term savings and managing debt. We want to focus on meeting our short-term obligations. So what we would do during panel two is we'd evaluate the adequacy of our emergency fund, which is cash that's set aside to pay for certain emergencies, like a repair we need on our house, or maybe a period of unemployment. We need an emergency fund for that, and we'd evaluate the adequacy of our emergency fund during panel two. We'd look at housing costs. There are some housing ratios, housing ratio one, housing ratio two, which are also called the basic and broad ratio. We're going to talk about those in a future module in this course, but we would analyze those housing ratios during panel two. And we'd also look at income spent on debt other than housing debt, so personal debt, credit card debt. So we would look at all of these during panel two. And then panel three involves long-term savings and investments. The focus is on being financially secure. We'd evaluate the progress toward our long-term goals, such as the retirement goal, education funding, a large purchase goal, such as the purchase of a home, and also legacy goals, such as the creation of documents like a will, a power of attorney, maybe even looking at leaving some assets to our children and grandchildren when we pass away. So let's do a practice question. Evaluating a client's proportion of income spent on housing would fall into, and we have panel one, panel two, panel three, or the distribution phase of the life cycle approach. And clearly it's not the distribution phase of the life cycle approach. It's going to be one of these three panels of the three-panel approach. And if you remember before, we said that we're going to look at an emergency fund, income spent on housing, income spent on debt other than housing. We look at all of those in panel two of the three-panel approach. So B is our answer. Two additional approaches to financial planning are the strategic approach and the cash flow approach. Let's talk about both of those right now. First, we'll talk about the strategic approach. And the strategic approach to financial planning combines big picture goals and the external environment, such as the economy, the investment markets, and so forth. It considers the client's needs, what they really need, and what they want. So it looks at what a client absolutely needs, like food and shelter, and what they want, such as discretionary spending like vacations, things like that. And we also include a SWOT analysis under the strategic approach. And what does SWOT stand for? It stands for strengths, weaknesses, opportunities, and threats. So we're going to be looking at a client's strengths, maybe of their financial statements, some weaknesses, some opportunities for them, maybe from an investment standpoint, and threats to their overall financial plan. The strategic approach is generally a big picture approach. It codifies client goals and objectives into a mission statement. You may want to highlight that. Very important that you know that the mission statement is created under the strategic approach. We typically don't have a mission statement that we create under the other approaches to financial planning. A mission statement is a brief, long-term statement of the financial plan's overarching purpose or mission. And it could say something like, this plan's mission is supporting our family and leaving an endowment to charity. That could be an example of a mission statement, a brief, long-term statement of the purpose of the overall plan. The strategic approach defines goals and objectives. The goals are broadly defined, like having an adequate emergency fund, and then the objectives are where we really specify what we want. It divides the goals into discrete and actionable steps. Another approach to financial planning is the cash flow approach. Planners using the strategic approach method often follow that by using the cash flow approach method. They work together, these methods. This approach uses the statement of income and expenses to make recommendations. Under this approach, we have the following steps. First, recommendations with positive cash flow impact are prioritized and implemented. Clients then identify recommendations with a negative cash flow impact. And then positive cash flows are used to purchase the negative cash flow recommendation. So we look at positive cash flows, negative cash flows, and we see how the positive cash flows can be used to pay for those negative cash flows. So let's look at a few ways that insurance recommendations would affect cash flow. There are some ways that insurance recommendations could have a positive cash flow impact. For example, if you have a homeowner's policy, and I'm your financial planner, and I'm looking at your cash flow, one way that we might be able to enhance your cash flow in a positive way is by increasing the deductible on that homeowner's policy, because that will lower your premiums and therefore reduce your expenses, which would result in positive impact on your cash flow statement. We could eliminate duplicate coverage if you have any. Possibly reduce coverage if you don't necessarily need as much coverage as you have, or replace the policy with a less expensive policy that provides the same coverage. Those are all ways that insurance recommendations can positively impact cash flow. In addition, there are some ways that insurance can negatively impact cash flow. For example, if we lower the deductible, maybe I'm looking at your insurance deductible for your homeowner's policy and it's just way too high. You just couldn't afford it if you had a fire to your house or something. So I recommend you lower the deductible. That's going to increase your premium, and that will increase your expenses, which will lower your cash flow. Maybe the purchase of new insurance, that would be a recommendation that would have a negative impact on cash flow. Or increasing existing coverage would also have a negative cash flow impact. And I'm not saying that it's bad to increase insurance coverage. I'm not saying that it's bad to purchase new insurance or lower deductibles. All I'm saying is that that would have a negative impact on your cash flow. It may be necessary to buy the new insurance. There are some insurance recommendations that do not impact cash flow. For example, changing the beneficiary of a life insurance policy would have no impact. Reassigning the policy, in other words, giving the policy to somebody else or putting it in a trust, that's not going to have an impact on cash flow. Or stop driving an uninsured vehicle, that's not going to impact cash flow at all. Under the cash flow approach, we take a look at the cash flow statement, which is a financial statement that financial planners prepare for clients. And this statement is used to determine how much income the client is receiving and how much the client is spending. Sometimes it's called the statement of income and expenses. We're going to refer to it though as the cash flow statement. And we do have a handout that came with your study guide, and it's titled the cash flow statement. So let's go ahead and take that out right now and just let's take a look at that real quick. And if you notice, it's broken up into different sections. The first section is annual income. So we have both spouses' salaries, investment income such as interest and dividends, and other sources of income as well. We then total up the income, and then we look at our expenses, and the expenses are broken up between non-discretionary expenses, which are expenses that we generally can't live without. For example, food and clothing and paying income taxes, paying the mortgage. Those are non-discretionary expenses. And we also have a section called discretionary expenses, which are usually expenses that we can reduce or eliminate if we're having cash flow problems. That includes things like vacations, travel, entertainment. And you'll notice under discretionary expenses, it even includes savings, saving for college education, saving and investing. Those are discretionary expenses. We can reduce our savings if our cash flow is problematic. It's often a good idea to separate the savings from expenses if you want to better understand cash flow, but on most cash flow statements, the savings are included under discretionary expenses. The cash flow statement is prepared for a period of time. Unlike the balance sheet or net worth statement, which is just prepared for one moment in time, a day, the cash flow statement is prepared for a period of time, either a month, a quarter, 6 months. In most cases, the cash flow statement's actually prepared for a year. In fact, if you notice our cash flow statement, it says for the year ended December 31st. So this is for a one-year period that we're looking at here. The net cash flow is income minus savings minus expenses. And that's exactly what we've done here on the cash flow statement. If you notice, our income is $230,000 and our savings and expenses total $201,000 because the savings is included with the expenses. And so the net cash flow is $29,000. Determining how much a client should be saving is one of the most important elements of financial planning. Financial goals almost always require the accumulation and growth of assets. That's especially true with a retirement planning goal and an education savings goal as well. And there are different ways that we can invest our assets to save for the future, and one is through the use of taxable savings accounts. Those are taxable in the year the income is earned. For example, let's say that you set up a savings account at a bank and it's paying you 1% interest. Every year when you earn that interest, you will pay tax on it. You don't get to pay tax when you retire. You pay tax when you earn the interest. A brokerage account as well is a taxable savings account. Any interest, dividends, capital gains, those are all taxed in the year earned. So if you have $5,000 of dividend income in the current year from your brokerage account, you will pay tax on the $5,000 this year. There are tax-deferred savings accounts, though, and those actually allow you to pay taxes later. You defer taxes now, and you don't pay taxes until you take the money out of those tax-deferred accounts. A great example of a tax-deferred savings account is a 401k plan. You contribute to the 401k plan, and the great news there is that you're usually getting a tax deduction up front when you contribute to the 401k plan. And then the earnings on the assets inside your 401k plan, they grow over time, and you don't pay any taxes while they're growing. As long as the money stays inside the 401k plan, you don't pay taxes on those earnings. You would only pay taxes on your 401k earnings when you take the money out, and that's usually during retirement. So if you're 30 years old, you retire at age 60, those assets in your 401k plan will grow for 30 years without you paying tax on it. You don't pay tax till later on. The taxes are deferred. Not only does it include 401k plans, it includes certain other types of IRAs, like traditional IRAs, SEPs, which is another type of IRA for small businesses, and simple IRAs also. It even includes 403b plans, which are similar to 401k plans, except they're used by a lot of tax-exempt organizations like universities. And then finally, we have tax-free savings accounts. Those offer tax-deferred growth and also allow for tax-free withdrawals. We said just a minute ago that with a 401k, it offers tax-deferred growth, but when you take the money out of the 401k plan, you will pay tax on that growth at that time. There are certain accounts, though, that allow for tax-deferred growth, and when you take the money out, you do not pay tax on it. So essentially, it's not just tax-deferred growth, it's tax-free growth, and that would include a Roth IRA. Money inside a Roth IRA grows tax-free. So let's say that I've got $5,000 in my Roth IRA. It grows over the next few years to be worth $20,000. Well, I'm not paying tax on that $15,000 of growth while it's happening. And then let's say that I'm 65 years old and I decide to go ahead and take the full $20,000 out of the Roth IRA. At that point, I don't pay any taxes on that $20,000 distribution either. So the entire amount of growth was completely tax-free. Roth IRAs are an example of a tax-free savings account. We also have health savings accounts and 529 plans that are also tax-free savings accounts. Although keep in mind with the 529 plan, it's not always tax-free. You have to use the money for education purposes when you take it out. Otherwise, it's taxable. Expenses on a cash flow statement are often broken down into different types of expenses. On our cash flow statement, we've broken them down between non-discretionary and discretionary, but there are some cash flow statements where they further break down the expenses to living expenses such as groceries, utilities, rent, internet, insurance, and of course some living expenses are discretionary, some are non-discretionary. Sometimes there's a separate category for just debt payments such as a mortgage or credit card debt payments. Sometimes there's a separate section for insurance costs such as life insurance, disability, and health, and taxes, which can include income and real estate taxes. Usually you don't see it broken down into this many sections. Typically a cash flow statement is going to look like our handout, which has a section for non-discretionary expenses and discretionary expenses. And the formula for net discretionary cash flow, it's the formula we said before, which is the net cash flow formula. It's our income minus savings minus expenses. And if you remember on our handout, we said that that amount was actually $29,000. Financial planning recommendations are made on the basis of available cash flow, so it's important from the standpoint of long-term success to make sure the client has a positive cash flow. Negative cash flows must be resolved by either increasing income, and you can do that sometimes by reallocating your investment assets or maybe taking on another job, or even reducing expenses, which may actually be easier than increasing income. So let's go through and take a look at the cash flow statement again and talk a little bit about the discretionary expenses, because it's going to be important on your exam for you to identify what is a discretionary expense. And as we said, discretionary expenses are those expenses a household can survive without. It's non-essential spending. Let's take a look at some of the discretionary expenses on our handout. And one of them is travel and vacations. Of course, we could theoretically live without that. If we are having cash flow problems, maybe we don't take a vacation. Entertainment, charitable contributions, household furnishings, that may be non-discretionary, but a lot of times it is discretionary. And then we have savings listed under discretionary expenses. We can always reduce our savings if we're having cash flow problems. And then there are sometimes other expenses as well, like gym memberships, hobbies, going out to restaurants versus eating in. Those are all examples of potential discretionary expenses. Non-discretionary expenses are necessary expenses, and if you look at our handout, we have utilities, food, taxes, medical expenses, current tuition costs, insurance premiums. Those are all examples of non-discretionary expenses. As great as the cash flow statement is, and as meaningful as it is when doing financial planning, there are some limitations. One limitation of a cash flow statement is that only recurring income and expenses are included. Some excluded items can have a significant impact on the financial plan overall. So we're only looking at really recurring items here, not one-off items that might apply next year or something. So that is a limitation. Non-recurring transactions are not reported on the cash flow statement, which could include gifts and inheritances. And even though they're not included on the financial statement, on the cash flow statement, we don't want to ignore those potential sources of income or potential expenses. So let's do a practice question. Which one of the following insurance strategies will result in a positive cash flow? What about changing the beneficiary from a spouse to a child? That has no impact on cash flow, so A is false. What about increasing insurance deductibles? That will lower our premiums, which will lower our expenses, which will have a positive cash flow impact. So B is our answer. Raising the amount of long-term care insurance coverage might be a necessity, but that's going to increase our premium and reduce our cash flow. It'll have a negative impact on cash flow. So C is false. And then D, switching from term life insurance to whole life insurance, that may have actually a negative cash flow impact because typically the whole life premiums are going to be higher than term premiums. So probably that's going to have a negative cash flow impact. The best answer here, the correct answer, is B. Let's talk about a few additional approaches to financial planning. There are four additional approaches to financial planning that you need to know for your exam, and they are the pie chart approach, the present value of all goals approach, the ratio analysis approach, and the metrics approach. Let's talk about each one of those individually. The first one is the pie chart approach, and that provides a visual display of the balance sheet and a visual display of the cash flow statement in the form of a pie chart. We might have one pie chart for the balance sheet, one pie chart for the cash flow statement. And for the example for the cash flow statement, maybe what we'll do is we'll show a different piece of the pie for each of the different expense categories. For example, housing costs could be 27%, savings 8%, for example. Maybe there's a piece of the pie chart that shows insurance costs. That could be 10%, for example. Maybe there's one for taxes as well. And the entire pie would add up to be 100%, which represents all the expenses. These pie charts are created after the internal data has been collected and the financial statements have been prepared. The balance sheet, the cash flow statement have been prepared. It displays percentages of various finances. It's a great visual display to see how much you're spending, see how much you have in liabilities and assets and so forth. It does help the clients visualize several things, including the percentage of pay that is actually being saved, or the percentage of pay that's spent on housing costs, or the percentage of pay that's spent on anything else that might be an important expenditure. It'll show the percentage of pay that is remaining after all these other expenditures. We might see percentage of pay spent on taxes. So this is the pie chart approach, a great visual approach. The second approach to financial planning is the present value of all goals approach. This is a multi-step process, and what it does is it gives the client a single dollar value to meet all their lifetime goals. That can be a really good thing to know, but it could also be very depressing. What if I told you that in order for you to meet all of your goals, retirement, education, buying a second home, you would need to have today $2 million set aside? Well, unfortunately, you may not have $2 million set aside. So, of course, as part of this process, I would tell you how much you needed to save by a certain date to get there. But the whole point of this approach is to take a present value of all of your goals and tell you how much you need today to fund those goals. It does also quantify the amount the client would need to start saving today. This method puts a price tag on all the client's lifetime goals. Let's go through the steps. First step is to determine the individual present values of each goal. So we're going to do some number crunching here, and we'll talk about present value in this course in a later module. But let's say that we run some numbers, and in order for you to successfully retire, let's say 25 years from now, you would need to have right now set aside $300,000. That's the present value today of your retirement goal. Maybe to pay for your education costs for your kids, you need to have set aside $200,000. And then for a second home, maybe you need to have set aside $100,000 today. When you add all of that up, that's $600,000. So for you to meet your goals today, you need to have $600,000. So what we'll do, we'll determine the individual present values of each goal. We'll sum those present values, which we just did, and that gave us $600,000 in our example. And then we reduce that total amount by the current resources available. Let's say you've already saved $150,000. So we take the $600,000, subtract out $150,000, and that means that the shortfall is $450,000. And we would determine the amount needed to fund these goals, the amount of additional savings needed. So we take the $450,000, and let's say that you've got 25 years, we'd figure out how much you would need to save each year to get that $450,000. So we go through the steps. We figure out the present value of each goal, sum the total, then subtract out the resources you already have set aside, and then figure out what you need to save to get there. The next approach is the financial statement and ratio analysis approach. And that uses data within the financial statements. Later on in this course, we'll be going through the financial statements, and we're going to be talking about a lot of different ratios that you need to know how to calculate for your exam. Right now, we'll just discuss briefly some of the ratios, but we're going to actually go through a lot of these ratios later on. So there are ratios that we would calculate in this approach, using, for example, the balance sheet, the net worth statement, and then we would use those ratios to gauge a person's financial health. There are various categories of ratios. That includes liquidity ratios, debt ratios, financial security ratios, and performance ratios, and we'll talk about those later, but just for example, liquidity ratios are used to determine an individual's ability to meet their short-term obligations. Performance ratios, those determine how adequate a rate of return is for an investment given the level of risk taken on. So we would look at these ratios under the ratio analysis approach and see how the client's doing. And then finally, we have the metrics approach. The metrics approach provides quantitative benchmarks as guidance for achieving goals. It helps to establish objectives that are measurable with ratio analysis, and it may be considered a rule of thumb. These are somewhat uncertain. There's no set list of benchmarks that we can use with absolute certainty. And I've seen different financial planners use different benchmarks. But one such benchmark, one such metric could be, for example, saying with life insurance, you should have anywhere from 10 to 15 times your gross pay in life insurance coverage. That's an example of a metrics. Another one could be disability. You should have disability coverage equal to anywhere from 60 to 80% of your gross pay. Maybe we have an emergency fund metric that says you have 3 to 6 months of non-discretionary expenses saved up in cash equivalents. So there are various metrics that we can apply, although they do differ based on the financial planner that's recommending these metrics. So let's do a practice question. Which of the following best describes the metrics approach to financial planning? An advisor computes a variety of ratios which are then used to gauge a client's financial health. Well, that's the financial statement and ratio analysis approach, so A is false. What about B? An advisor gives their client a single dollar value to meet all their lifetime goals. That's the present value of all goals approach, so B is incorrect. An advisor provides a visual display of the balance sheet and cash flow statements. That's obviously the pie chart approach. So C is false. D, an advisor provides quantitative benchmarks for their client to use as guidance for achieving comprehensive financial goals. That obviously is the metrics approach, so D is our answer. Let's wrap up Module 3 by talking about budgeting and saving. Budgeting is very, very important. Everybody should do it, but most people don't do it. When you are doing budgeting, there are some important tips that you should consider. Number one, be realistic with spending behavior. Number two, include an expense line item for miscellaneous expenses and unforeseen expenses. And then number three, practice. Being successful with budgeting takes practice. So let's go through the steps of the budgeting process. The first step of the budgeting process is to determine income for a time period. So let's say that you are doing budgeting for a client of yours. The first thing you want to do is look at their income, determine their income. And you could do that through pay stubs, other prior year documents like 1099s. Talk to the client. You want to first determine their income for a time period. And the time period could be a month, could be a quarter, could be a year. But determining income is the first step. The second step is determining fixed and variable expenses for the same time period. So if you're looking at income for a year, you want to look at expenses for a year. And you want to look at fixed expenses, and fixed expenses are stable and predictable. And oftentimes, fixed expenses are non-discretionary, such as a mortgage payment. That's usually fixed in amount, and certainly that would be a non-discretionary expense. Although it should be noted that fixed expenses are not always non-discretionary. There are some discretionary expenses that are fixed. For example, if you have a subscription to a streaming service, that might be $15 a month, and that's a fixed expense, but that certainly could be considered discretionary, not non-discretionary. You also want to look at variable expenses, which vary from month to month. That could be, for example, entertainment, travel, things of that nature. Usually variable expenses are discretionary, but not always. The next step is present these expenses to the client. And you want to present these expenses to the client in both dollar values and percentages of income so they can see both of these figures. And you also want to show a comparison of this year's budget to previous year's budget. What you'll probably find is that expenses as a percentage of income are generally level or decreasing over time. You want to show all this information to the client, though, not only the dollar amount, but the percentage of income that that expense represents. The next step is to determine if the net discretionary cash flow is positive or negative. If it's positive, there's really no action that needs to be taken. That's a good thing. If it's negative, though, we've got to figure out what to do here. We need to either reduce expenses or figure out some ways to increase income. The last step is really figuring out what to do, rectifying the client's goals and planner recommendations with the client's cash flow. If there's a cash deficit, it may involve telling the client that they need to eat out less, take less vacation, figure out some other ways to reduce expenses, or maybe other ways to increase income. The good news, though, is that a cash surplus could allow us to do some additional good things like save more money or give more to charity. Those are the steps of the budgeting process. We also want to figure out a savings rate for the client. There are two ways to do this. There's the cash flow approach, which takes income minus savings minus expenses. But the other approach, the ratio approach, is something that you definitely will need to know for your exam. And that's calculating a percentage, a savings rate. And the savings rate under the ratio approach is expressed in the following formula. It's taking savings, which would represent the client's contributions to their 401k plan or contributions to a traditional IRA, just other amounts set aside and saved, plus an employer match. It's important to note that an employer matching contribution to a 401k plan counts in the numerator of the savings rate. You take the savings plus the employer match and then divide that by the gross pay, and that's the savings rate. And then you want to compare that to an appropriate benchmark. Depends on the client, though. The benchmark is going to be influenced by the client. The appropriate benchmark for a client's savings rate depends on various factors. It depends on the client's income, their current investment balance, their rate of return, and their inflation rate. It even depends on their age. Generally, younger clients and clients with fewer goals have lower savings rate benchmarks, whereas older clients and clients with more goals have higher savings rate benchmark. For example, you might have a 25-year-old couple with two kids, and they have a retirement savings goal. They have the goal of buying a house, education funding goal as well. And you want to look at the savings rates for all three of those goals and add them together. That could be a 15 or 20% total savings rate benchmark for that particular couple. So let's do some practice questions. What is the first step in the budgeting process? And we have determining the client's income, determining expenses, determining the client's net discretionary cash flow, and determining goals. And as we said with the budgeting process, the first thing that you want to do is determine your client's income. So A is our answer. Janet Smith receives a salary of $150,000. She saves $10,000 in a 529 plan for her son and contributes $12,000 to her 401k plan. Her employer also makes a $4,000 matching contribution to her 401k plan. Assuming Janet also contributes $2,000 into a traditional IRA, what's her savings rate? What we're going to do is we're going to add up all of these savings items. We'll take the $10,000 contributed to the 529 plan, the $12,000 she put in her 401k plan, and also the $2,000 that she put into a traditional IRA. So $10,000 plus $12,000 is $22,000. Plus $2,000 for the traditional IRA, that's $24,000. That's her savings. We're also going to add in the employer match, which is $4,000. So now we're up to $28,000. That's our numerator. So we take the $28,000, we're going to divide that by her gross pay, which is $150,000. And if you take $28,000 divided by $150,000, that gives you 18.67%. So D is our answer, and that concludes Module 3.